which is clearly key, but I felt that it was very dismissive of a physiological approach, so I decided to title my talk Why Physiology Matters. One of the old problems with linking demography with environmental components is that there's an extremely long time span between when an event occurs and when you actually have the outcome in terms of growth. And so many things can happen along the way that it really creates a lot of difficulty in interpretation. And this is really problematic for southern resident killer whales because they have all these transitions that they go through. In wintertime, we know that it's a very, very different time period. Some people say it's a harsher time of year for them, but certainly it's very, very different from early spring when they're coming into early spring runs, when they get into the Salish Sea, and you have a whole other transition where it's a whole other food source that they're foraging on. So these kinds of things really make it difficult to connect the dots just using the straight long-term demographic approach. And it's compounded by the fact that reproduction is the most variable component of population growth. And most reproductive failure occurs very, very early. And what we see are the females when they arrive with a calf. We don't see any of that variability, that lot of variability between conception and early postpartum is missed. So to be able to look at these kinds of things in a way that we can really start to do adaptive management can be very difficult with this overall demographic approach, which is extremely important, but should not be used alone, I would argue. And I would also argue that physiology is really the bridge here. And when you look in the literature, we have this concept of allostatic load introduced by John Greenfield and a number of other prominent physiologists, talking about all of the combined physiological pressures that animals are faced with and the energy required to keep the body in a homeostatic level. And when the combined pressures get too high, you get into a period of allostatic load, which can cause a lot of problems. If you get into a point of allostatic overload, then you're really in trouble. There's a tremendous amount of physiological literature measuring these kinds of dynamic changes that are taking place and how they tie to potentially demographic consequences. And then there is also the reproductive component, which I already got at, that, you know, there's David Lapp in a very prominent, very well-known paper in 1954, The Natural Regulation of Animal Numbers, talked about the importance of animals controlling the time of reproduction and regulating this accordingly. This was followed by a paper by G.C. Williams called Natural Selection, the Cost of Reproduction and the Refinement of Lax Principles. When G.C. Williams was the editor of Quarterly Review of Biology, I published a paper then in 1983 while he was the editor talking about the physiological measurement of these kinds of reproductive failure that they were talking about, and the enormous number of mechanisms that are out there. So if we can combine the allostatic load idea of getting at growth and survivorship to reproduction, that's the bridge to get us between the events of fish, let's say, and demographic outcomes. Now, there are many factors that can influence a given hormone. That was a point made in the report, which it looked at it, that as though it was a weakness. I consider that a strength. Because if you are able to sample along, comprehensively enough, then you can monitor how hormones change in relation to these multiple changing pressures. And some pressures may cause the same hormone to go up, whereas another pressure may cause that hormone to go down. And so by being able to monitor those over time, that's how you use this to your benefit. And one of the tremendous benefits that we have done with our sampling now is bringing in the scat detection dog, which allows us to sample at a very, very high frequency to get at all of these trends over time. When I wrote this review, someone asked me to bring in another example, so I thought I would bring in one example of a physiological impact on work we're doing in the Alberta oil sands. You may know this is the second most important oil resource in the world, and caribou are endangered in that area. This is very soft soil, so the oil workers can only go there in the winter when the ground is frozen, and our dogs are sampling there at minus 10 degrees, 2 feet of snow. Four dogs in 10 weeks will bring home 1,500 samples. But essentially what happens is for 9 months out of the year, there's no people on the landscape, and then all of a sudden it shifts from very few to 1,500 people in a matter of a few weeks, and then back down again by the middle of March.
Now, the first thing we did was look at pregnancy. You can see that progesterone, this is progesterone in females versus males. In the wintertime, virtually all caribou are females are pregnant. You can see a very, very clear difference between pregnancy in females and males. You can also see for females only that the progesterone levels increase with time as they should in a normal pregnancy, whereas in males here, you see there's really no change in time. So that shows us that progesterone is a very nice measure of pregnancy. We also measured diet in these SCAD samples. We took 500 SCAD samples, sent them to Washington State University. They did 100 different microscopic views of each sample to see what's the dominant food type. You could see that 60% of what they were eating was lichen. Very, very high glucose, high fiber material that not many animals can eat, but extremely important because high glucose is vital for the fetus. That virtually the only food a developing fetus eats is glucose. And all the other different foods you can see are around the 5% or less levels. So lichen is driving the bus here. And when we created a spatial model over the area based on satellite imagery to be able to tell us where the lichen areas were richest, and that's showing us here going from 0 to 1 being the highest, and this is relative to lichen in the diet, actually measured from those WSU samples. You can see a beautiful linear relationship. When you measure this relative to cortisol or glucocorticoids, which serves to mobilize glucose under nutritional emergencies, you find a beautiful negative trend. When the lichen is low, and therefore you're not getting much lichen, glucocorticoids are very high. When lichens become high, they plummet. So we show a really nice tie between the amount of lichen in the diet and glucocorticoids, and this is showing you progesterone levels, controlling for the time of progesterone. When you have a lot of lichen in the area, you can see that progesterone goes up, so a lot of lichen means a very healthy pregnancy. Poor lichen means an unhealthy pregnancy. Well, I mentioned that in this habitat, you have a situation, a temporal effect going on where when the people first arrive in the first session we sampled, there's not many people on the landscape yet. Here's that linear relationship I showed you between lichen availability and progesterone. But when people come into the landscape in session B and C, when they're peaking here, then that relationship between lichen and progesterone goes away. And when they leave again, it comes back. So here's a situation when all these people are on the landscape, the primary roads growing are put in the same places where lichen occurs because the soil conditions are the best for roads. You can see that even though the lichen's there, they can't access them, and it's impacting their pregnancy hugely. Now, in the SCAD detection dog, you kind of have a similar kind of a situation. They come into the Salish Sea, and they've got the boats around there. But basically, with our detection dogs, we do a very interesting sampling that allows us to really get a good distribution of the sample. We start sampling in the front of the pod, and then every time the pod is moving through, when we get to the back, we hopscotch back to the front. And we're doing that all day long so that we're continuously sampling the population. Every one of our samples is genotyped by Mike Ford and Linda Park's lab and Kim Parsons, others. So we are able to control for that in all of our analyses. We look at glucocorticoids, which, again, serve to mobilize glucose. They increase under psychological stress and under nutritional stress. They're fairly fast-acting. We look at thyroid hormone, which really regulates only nutrition, not psychological stress. It's dealing more with metabolism. It's a slower changing relationship. Thyroid hormone, when your body is running out of food, you lower your metabolism, so you're more conservative and use the limited food you have more conservatively. So it's a more slower acting hormone. And essentially, increased glucocorticoid is bad, a decreased thyroid hormone is bad. So when you look at this relative to the southern resident killer whales, we have a situation where, as we described, now I'm going to present two more years of data than I presented last the talk I gave in the first session. And again, we have a situation where when they first arrive, the boats are low and the fish are low in the Salish Sea. They peak roughly the same time, and then they go down again. So you can have a situation that if boats are driving the situation, then at that peak, glucocorticoids should be highest. If fish are driving it, glucocorticoids should be lowest at that point in time. Similarly, with thyroid hormone, which is acting more slowly, we see that, and it's probably particularly good at getting these transitions because it's slower change. So when they come out of feeding in the spring and they arrive, those early arrival thyroid hormone levels are really reflecting where they just came from, as well as over time they're reflecting also what's there. But when they're coming in, it's more where they came from. So if you look at cortisol, glucocorticoid, plotted by the number of fish, this is based on the Albion test fishery looking at catch per unit effort, you see that there's a very nice linear relationship that cortisol is highest when fish are low. When fish are high, then cortisol declines. And you can, and that's consistent with this whole idea of food. You do not see this relationship with number of boats. But if you go and you look at this as a quadratic equation, cortisol over time by Julian date, what you see is a nice smile here where cortisol is actually the lowest at that peak I was talking about when the fish are highest and the boats are highest. And so this is very strongly suggestive of the idea that it's fish that's driving this physiological signal here, not boats. And when you look at this by cod, you see a very interesting trend. So this is really showing you how this line changes from cod. It's lowest in J, highest in K, middle in K, and highest in L. And it doesn't matter whether it's linear or quadratic your time is to. And interestingly, mortality is highest in the L pod and lowest in the J pod. J pod also has the most exposure to boats. So it's showing you that this physiology does seem to be reflecting what is going on here, and that glucocorticoids are one important component of that. Similarly, when you look at thyroid hormone, I mentioned this is a more slower acting, and you look at this by Julian date, and you see this consistent linear pattern. This is from 4 years of data that when they arrive consistently, thyroid hormone is the highest and declines over time, suggesting that they if you think about it, they came out of winter, which we're presuming, I'm presuming, is a very, very harsh time. But that when they arrive here in the Salish Sea, several, many months later, they're in their best physiological condition. And that suggests that there's some food source likely in between there, this early spring run of Chinook, perhaps, that is very, very important. I mean, Mike presented data saying they spend 68% of their time near the, in that time of year, April, near the Columbia River. We know that those early Chinook are the fattiest of all the salmon that we see, so it's a big opportunity for them to replenish themselves coming out of the winter and make sure that they have enough reserves to deal with the delay in the Fraser River salmon run. And again, you can express this as a quadratic, and you see that it's even sharper. This early time that they arrive is very important. All of this, again, is controlling for individual, age, sex. And the one thing you see here is this interesting impact of year. And so it's the overall thyroid hormone was lowest in 2008, highest in 10, and then declining. It didn't matter which pattern you're doing. Used, but what's really interesting about that is when you look at that mean thyroid hormone level over the year relative to the number of births across those 4 years, granted it's only four data points, but look at that line. It's like the correlation is like 0.8. So as you have, when you have high thyroid hormone, you have high births. Low thyroid hormone, low births of that year. Deaths also fit that pattern very, very nicely. Again, a correlation of close to 0.8. And you see that when thyroid hormone is high, deaths are low. When thyroid hormone is low, deaths are high. When you tie that to, again, the correlation between the looking at the area under the curve of early Chinook runs at the Columbia River, you see, again, a fairly interesting positive relationship. The more Chinook at the Columbia River, the higher the thyroid hormone when they arrive in the Salish Sea. But we also see that when you look at the area under the curve for the early Fraser River runs, the first 50 days, you know, from Julian date 150 to 200, I can't convert that in my brain too quickly. But again, we see a very tight relationship. So this is consistent with the idea that you have these transitions. You come out of winter, you have a rich food source that you're feeding on in the early spring. That's important to sustain you for the, whatever's going to happen in the Fraser River run, because from year to year, the variation in when that Fraser run peaks and how much is there before it peaks is incredibly high. And so they need something to buffer them, and it seems to be having an important demographic effect. The last thing I want to point out is toxins. We've heard a lot about toxins in this situation. We are also now measuring toxins in our samples, and this is showing you the PCB levels in the scat and glue versus the blubber. You can see for all these different congeners, we have a fantastic similarity between the amount of scat and toxins and blubber versus, oh my God, the amount of toxins in blubber versus the amount of toxins in scat. Now think about this, because with the scat sample, you have to take a biopsy, and you've got, you know, someone was saying, how many samples do you have? Maybe 35 biopsies they have over a many-year period. Well, we're getting 150 in a year. So the ability to tie the toxin levels across by looking at the impact of diet, when you're talking about, are you getting the toxins when you're eating the fish, or is it the toxin stored in your fat, and when you start to become more nutritionally deprived, burn fat, is that when the toxins show up? We can show that with these samples combined with the dog sampling. And we also get a very nice signal about, you heard about the signal between K and L-pod for high levels of DDT versus J having higher PCB. Look at this. This is also in the scat. You see that consistently K and L are in yellow, are always above, way above the line, and J is below the line, looking at the ratio of DDT relative to PCBs. So the idea is that if we're really going to try to connect these two kinds of the long-term demographic approach, it's very important to try to take advantage of this physiological bridge that we have offered by being able to get this biological material from scat with a sampling regime that works very, very well. And this will allow us to do interesting things with mitigation. If you think about it, again, if we find that fish are really what's driving the system here, and when fish are low, maybe boats start to matter, or when fish are low, if you're starting to dump your toxins into your system, one of the things that this is starting to tell us, if those hypotheses are correct, which we're testing, then that means that the best way to keep this thing stable over the short term is to keep those fish high so that you have more time to clean up the sound. And that means that we have to do things like, you know, maybe we have to adjust fisheries, I don't know, but certainly we have to think about increasing carrying capacity of these, increasing habitat to raise the number of fish so you can raise the number of killer whales so they can sustain these kinds of things, dealing with habitat issues. The timing of runs may be key. And so, because we're seeing that if you get into the Fraser River and there's a really long delay, that's very hard on them physiologically. And so, it may be that you don't regulate all fishery, but there may be certain times where it's actually very valuable to regulate the fishery, such as these early spring runs, when we know that is such a critical one, or when they come into the early part of the future, somehow to say the sea. Those may be important to regulate. I don't know, but I can tell you if you do it in a year, we'll see the physiological effect the very next year with these samples. And that's powerful adaptive management. The other thing is that, you know, by doing this, you can see how mitigation improves over time. And I would say a few tools offer that. And I just want to give you end with one important example, which was L90. Last time we had this conference, L90. Someone thought got struck by a boat. And everybody was out there looking at L90, and nobody could see any indication it was struck by a boat. There was no wounds, no nothing. At this conference, before the conference, we got a tissue sample from her, sent them out. At this conference, we found that the tissue had sperm in it, which meant it was vaginal tissue. And then we found that L90 was actually pregnant, extremely high progesterone levels, high cort, high testosterone, clear pregnancy signal, she aborted. I think that's enough. I need a boat. That's why this picture's here. So if you want to give me a boat, I'd really be happy because I could double. Thank you very much. There's an assumption, because there is a very strong linear component to this, that the arrival of T3 is really, really setting the stage for how the progression changes, because the slope of the line of postures doesn't change. So we took the mean T3 for that year and looked at the burst over that whole year from the time, you know, from the time that they that we took those fingers on the line. And same thing. Right.
So we did the number of births that occurred in the year that we took the mean T3 level for. Yes.
The mean total T3 in whales.
Yes, across the year. Yeah. So for all the whales, we control for individual, but in analysis, but it doesn't really do much because it's only four samples. Without trying to make too much out of those slides, the real point of that was how incredible, you can't make much about four samples, but the tightness of those on the line, of the total amount of T3, when they arrived, that's how healthy they were, and that's reflecting what they had in what conditions were like in the early spring, and then from then on, and then we're talking about the births over that same year period. So those births, we only see the births once they arrive, of course. And then the same thing has to go through the deaths. So the point of this is that this seems to be very strongly reflecting what's going on. But four samples is not enough to say that. Hopefully, the country will be able to put the deaths down. But I have to admit, four samples or not, that's pretty damn tight.
Well,
in terms of seasonal changes, I mean, much of those are really going to be driven by thermal regulation, and really the literature is all over the map on whether thyroid hormone has a seasonal effect or not. Some species it does, some species it doesn't. But the fact of the matter is, if you're talking about this as a thermal regulatory demand, I mean, we're talking about California to Seattle versus Alaska whale, and whales with a very high blubber content. So that amount of temperature change that is occurring over this period of time is extremely unlikely to have an impact. But the other thing that I would argue about that is that I didn't present this in this talk, but in the talk I gave the last time, you saw that thyroid hormone. When you look at the actual shapes of the curve, you start to find that when the females first arrive, thyroid hormone is very high, and then it starts to plummet, and then it doesn't level off until the Fraser River fish peak. And there's tremendous variability over the years in those fish, and then that peaks. And that was also very, very consistent with the fish run. If it was a seasonal pattern, you simply would not see that. The other thing is that if you look at the difference between years in these patterns, again, a seasonal trend is not going to explain these differences in the overall levels of T3 across years. So these are the values that I use the most. And so that also is inconsistent with a seasonal signal here. And, if you just look at how this is how the Fraser River run varies across years. I mean, there's enormous variability here. And, in a year like 2011, you've got this very, very long lag until fish are there. If you didn't get a good surge in the Columbia River, you're cooked here. And the thyroid hormone seems to be reflecting those signals in the amount of data that we currently have.
Captain sea lions I've worked with, we restrict their food, we can get two types of responses. And a severe restriction is the suppression of the catalyst, sort of fasting, starvation. Or if you just bring down a little bit, you see the nitrogen increase in the catalyst. So we look at that sort of 100 responses, they're going to increase the amount of energy that's going to go. And so when I look then at your results on this, I can interpret it two ways. One is the way you've interpreted, which is it came in good shape and it got worse as the summer went on. Another is that it came in with this hunger response, motivated, and as feeding conditions improved, T3 came down to normal levels. So
that's extremely unlikely. I have to say, I appreciate the experiments you do, but you've got to think about how you're doing your experiments. You have a metabolism where you put an animal in there in a single space,
and over a very, very quick time period, you're restricting its content, its food intake. That's very useful information, but that's very, very different from the long-term trends that are going on in these populations. We see, if you look at thyroid hormone in general, let's just take the human population. We know thyroid hormone explains why diets don't work, because people start to starve themselves. Thyroid hormone lowers, their metabolism lowers, and they gain more energy from that potato chip than they would otherwise. We know that people that are hypothyroid are overweight, and we know that people that are hyperthyroid are very thin. We also know that when you start to adjust your thyroid medicine, it doesn't fix right away. It's because it's a very, very slow regulating thing, and it makes sense. It's controlling your metabolism. So basing those results on experiment that you know, while they're valuable, they're not measuring the same thing here. You're putting an animal in a single animal in a tight metabolism cage, immediately shutting off their food. That's not how this is happening. And so you might be right, but I don't believe it.
But even then, Sam, you know, beyond even our own captive studies, there's also precedent in published literature showing that there are cases where T3 rises, or at least symptoms fall. So I think in terms of the T3, the one still needs to be a bit cautious to really clear on what the mechanism is, how to change, and what is normal.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that we need more years of data. I think that this is a very, very suggestive case and that more work is needed. But one thing I will say is that physiology is an extremely valuable approach, and I felt that the panel report just outright dismissed it, and I thought that was really unfortunate.
Other comments?
Sam, that was an interesting presentation. I'm exhausted. It's great. But I wanted to ask Andrew's question in a slightly different way, because I have a somewhat similar concern. And part of this concern comes out of, you know, the longstanding observations of field biologists. When field whales arrived in the spring, we felt for years that they were in poor condition, and their condition increases throughout the season. And this is a number of things that contribute to that impression. One is ketosis. They often are ketotic when they arrive and rarely are later in the season. Another one is we see this change in their social behavior throughout the season. So they're all business when they arrive and they become more social throughout the season. Of course, there are confounding and other explanations for those kinds of phenomena. But I guess what it seems to me that animals have a couple of different strategies. And surely have one of the strategies, as Andrew's alluded to nutritional stress. And then sometimes it's going to make sense to ramp up, work harder to get prey. And other times it's going to make sense to ramp down and wait for prey to increase. Now, the thing that's I think you have to take into consideration with cobras is they have substantial body reserves compared to most of the terrestrial critters that have been studied over the years. And that means that they can afford to... they can get through bottlenecks, let's say, after a couple of months, if they start in fairly good condition. So it seems to me, at least, you have to admit the possibility that they've evolved a response mechanism whereby they arrive ramped up from arriving from a condition of relative nutritional stress, and arrive all ready to start chowing down and spend energy.
Right. Personally, you're talking about behavioral observations, which are valuable, but they're much more difficult to interpret than physiology. We see that cortisol, the glucocorticoid, which is a much more rapid responding system, does reflect the fact that when they first arrive, that food is low in the Fraser River. But we do get a different signal with thyroid, and again, the different time frame for the two is what I'm basing my argument on. I'm sure it could be wrong. I don't think so. But, you know, it's a tough thing to say, and this is part of the problem, is that we don't know. There's all these assumptions, but we don't have a clue, really, what's going on. We know that, there is, in my mind, winter is a very, very hard time.
and there's a long interval between winter and when they arrive here. So how do they cope with that? And the fact that they come in with such high T3 levels really, to me, suggests that they got some big surge of food. I don't really see how that would be possible otherwise. But you know, again, we need more data. The point I'm trying to make with this talk is that this is a very, very valuable tool. Like any tool, you have to be careful on how you are interpreting it. It's relatively new applications, but we're seeing consistent trends in the killer whale, with work we're doing on caribou, with work we're doing on spotted owls, and these signals are all bearing out using this non-invasive approach, collecting the samples in nature as they're changing in real time, and that really is giving us an important added piece to this puzzle, and you know, that's really the point of my talk.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question, and then we have a break.
Maybe just a comment. Generalized about upper performing spring chinook and flipper. It's a nice comment that there are really three different spots on the Columbia River. And sort of surmising the Bonneville area, that's Bonneville counts. So those are upper Columbia River spring chinook. They're not caught in ocean fisheries at all. There's two other groups in the areas below them. Greater. Sort of there's some detail in stock from
the fantastic. So